Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
And we have an action-packed show for you again today. No, we do not have audio of Kevin in the woods in search of Bambi. Not that kind of action-packed. We don't have that. We do have sports action for you and plenty of it. 5-7 teams going to bowl games. How about that one? Won't really get into that too heavy. Won't do that today, maybe tomorrow. Tomorrow's show, by the way, will be from Boston. We've done the show in many different areas. I don't think we've ever done the show from Boston before. But the show is going to be in Boston tomorrow. The show then will be in D.C. A week from today in Washington. And eventually the show is going to be in Las Vegas. I knew this show could play Vegas. I knew it. And we'll do that for the months out. It is a heavy travel month for me. Heavy travel month for me, without question. We'll find out some answers to some things along the way here. I think it's good. We're going to have a fun show coming up for you today. Let's see. What do we have on the rundown? By the way, Tony Knopp, I want to get into something very quickly. Tony Knopp is going to be joining us on the show on Thursday. We've had Tony for a while. Tony is, since we had Tony on, he and his wife had a baby. We have a lot to talk to him about, especially with the Los Angeles NFL situation, since he's right there. And what do we have for you today? Oh, I don't know. How about in a few moments, Matt Leon from CBS Philadelphia on the Eagles situation? How about Penn State women's soccer coach Erica Walsh? Penn State is playing in the national semifinals in the College Cup Friday against Rutgers in Cary, North Carolina. We also have Ben Jones, StateCollege.com on the show today, and Frank Bodani from the York Daily Record. So we have a lot going on today. Matt Leon joins us from Philadelphia next as we continue on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Okay, let's bring in Matt Leon from CBS Philly, KYW-TV and radio in Philadelphia. Matt, first of all, are they the guy that rented the plane to fly it over Florida and follow Al Golden, has he now rented the plane for the link?
No, not yet. Not yet, but it is as bad as I can remember around here. I don't think a lot of people thought the Eagles would win on Thursday, but I think people expected a better effort than we saw in that loss to Tampa Bay. And to basically see the exact same thing and to see a coaching staff that really doesn't seem to have any answers is disturbing on many levels.
But here's the other part. They did deal Nick Foles for Sam Bradford, and Nick Foles has not done well with the Rams. Actually, Sam Bradford's played better for the Eagles than Nick Foles for the Rams. Fair enough.
Oh, no, absolutely. But you got to remember, the Eagles also gave up a second-round pick in that deal.
That's true.
And the way things are going right now, you're talking about a pick that we're assuming the bottom will continue to fall out. A second-round pick that's going to be mid-30s, you know, 34, 35, 36. And that's a lot to give up for you know, a quarterback who, you know, now is injured, has been pretty good. I'm actually kind of a Bradford guy. I think the arrow's been pointing up on him as the season is going on.
Yeah.
But is he going to be the long-term guy? Is he going to be here next year? If he's not here next year and you gave up the second-round pick to basically rent him for 10, 12, 14 games, however many he ends up playing, not good.
We saw Jeff Fisher go off the deep end when asked about his team's effort. It was actually a very simple question. It was not a complicated effort. Basically, what did you think of your team's effort? And he went off the deep end about it.
All right.
No offense. It was a pretty simple, benign question. Are people questioning the effort of the Eagles?
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, Chip Kelly steadfastly says he's getting the effort, you know, and you listen to players, you know, to some of their talk shows and such, and the assistant coaches, and everyone says that, you know, at least publicly they're saying the team's giving effort. I'm not smart enough. I don't get to look at film. I'm not smart enough X and O's to say, you know, who's doing what they should be or who's not going to the nth degree. But I don't think you give up 90 points in 2 weeks to, let's face it, two mediocre at best football teams, and everyone is going 100% on every play. I think that's just kind of pretty basic stuff there.
I know I brought this up last week, but I'll revisit it again. This was allegedly the soft underbelly of the schedule to set them up for December, and this makes it exponentially more disturbing because they went through the soft underbelly 0-3.
Oh, yeah, and they went 0-3, you know, and earned it. Now, you think about that Miami debacle where they blow a 16-3 first quarter lead against a Miami team that was just begging to roll over, a Miami team that just had the buses ready and the engines rolling, and the Eagles refused to let them take the game. You know, and then Tampa Bay is a team that's a young team, and you like their future. I think they've got some pieces in place. But they are a mediocre team. They just hung 12 points up on a bad Colts defense, and you let them go up and down the field. And then this game against Detroit, yeah, Detroit had won two straight, and they were playing a little better since they had cleaned house, but they were still a 3-7 football team for a reason. And you were in the game, you know, till about 10-1, and that's about it. I mean, now you're face staring down the barrel of New England. You've got Arizona, you've got Buffalo, and then you got a couple NFC East games to wrap things up. But yeah, that's what's really bad about this. Is these were three games. I think most fans had them at 7-4 after these three games. I think most pundits had them at least 6-5. And you look at it, and they're 4-7, and in complete crisis mode. It's beyond alarming.
Is there an area of the football team where it's actually surprised you and thought, you know what? I mean, because, look, the bottom line is, you know, you can talk schemes and this and that all you want. Sometimes the guys you have just aren't good enough. All right, they just sometimes they aren't good enough. So where aren't they good enough right now?
Wide receiver, for one. Offensive line, for two. Offensive line might actually be one because the offensive lineman, Chip Kelly hasn't drafted an offensive lineman since he took Lane Johnson in the first round in 2013. So that's the rest of that 2013 draft. And then the 2014 and 2015 draft, they didn't draft one offensive lineman.
Right.
And this is something that has gone from a real strength a year and a half ago to a complete liability because Jason Peters, you know, talking about a guy who's a warrior, but a guy who's playing, who's, you know, torn his Achilles twice, is in his 30s, is now getting banged up as older offensive linemen tend to do. Jason Kelce is getting older, getting banged up. You let Evan Mathis walk. You let Todd Harriman's walk, and you didn't replace them with anyone. All you did was just promote the two guys who couldn't beat them out for the job to take their place. And Lane Johnson hasn't had this hasn't been Lane Johnson's best season. I think you kind of start to fall victim to everything around you. But, you know, and then you've got Lane Johnson. So they can't get anything continuity up front. They're not getting the push they used to get. And wide receiver, you know, Jordan Matthews is a nice wide receiver, but he's probably just a guy on most teams. And here he's being asked to be a number one. I mean, the fact that, you know, one of the things that's just amazing to me is the way they rotate. They will rotate Riley Cooper and Miles Austin. So basically one of those guys is on the field on every play,
right,
unless they're in a, you know, some sort of a tighter formation or whatever. Those are two guys who are not NFL wide receivers, I think, on any other team in the NFL. And this team makes sure that one of them is on the field at all times. And that just kind of screams, I think, maybe to a little of the tone deafness of the personnel and just the lack of talent.
Right. Are there empty seats in that place now when they play at home because of some disgust? I don't want to go to this. I'm going to stay home even though we already paid for this.
I think now you'll probably start to see that. The last two have, or Miami and Tampa Bay, I think people were still on board and thought they could turn this around. Yeah. And Detroit was obviously on the road, and they'll be at Foxborough this week.
Right.
When they come home to play Buffalo, I would think you would start to see that. Because it's really – there's still anger, but I do think there is a portion of the fan base, and at this point it might be a smaller portion, but there is a portion that's kind of pushing towards apathy, because it's not just that they're losing. They're not fun to watch. And that was the one thing when they hired Chip Kelly. You thought, hey, if nothing else, I'm going to get entertainment for 3 hours on Sunday. They're going to be up and down the field. They're going to move the football. They're going to do some innovative things. And it's really, it's when you take a step back and think about it in the big picture, it is truly stunning to think of where they are, that not only are they a bad football team, but they are a predictable football team that does nothing to move the needle.
When it comes to the Okafor situation with the Sixers, Matt, is this just a case of youth? How embarrassed is the organization? Is there an explanation for it?
I mean, me personally, and really the only person in the organization that talks is Brett Brown, and you don't hear much from the owner. You hear very little from GM Sam Hinkie. Now, they are back home tonight. When all of this kind of came to fruition, they were on the road, so it'll be interesting to see if there is a, you know, somebody from the organization that really takes some questions on the bigger picture here. Me personally, and as someone who really doesn't get a chance to go to many games and just kind of watching it for most people, I think a lot of this is youth. Is it reckless? Absolutely. Is it ill-advised? Absolutely. Is it wrong? Absolutely. But a lot of this stuff is a 19-year-old kid who, you know, is in the NBA and truly is dealing with something and losing. He's never had to deal with like this. You know, he's never had that. He's used to being, the focus of adulation. And here he's right now, because of the state of the team, he's part of a punchline. And I think it's got to be tough at that age to come to grips with. I think I read this morning that they're going to start putting a bodyguard with them, and kind of surprising to me that there wasn't more in that direction done earlier, but who knows what's going on behind the scenes. But for me personally, I tend to point a little bit towards youth and immaturity than I do a bigger picture problem.
Right. And the Sixers, I mean, I know the Daily News decided to do a piece with their writers back in, I don't know, May. They said, when do you think they'll be relevant and a playoff team again? Each one wrote their little piece. Dick Girardi had one word: never. Is it really that thought? I mean, now I know how Dick feels. That was not inaccurate. But are they really that irrelevant in the city? Because I've talked to Doug Collins about how the situation played out with him, so I know a little bit of background there. But how bad is it in terms of their perception in the city?
I mean, right now, there are a lot of people that have completely tuned them out. There are a lot of people that believe in what they're trying to do and kind of understand the concept that the only way you can really win big in the NBA is to get a superstar. And the way the league is set up and the way the draft is set up, the only way to get a superstar is basically through the draft. And so they're trying to do everything they can to get into that position. I thought this was the year where you would start to see significant improvement, maybe not playoffs, but a team that got into the 30s in wins and the arrow would really soon start to be pointing up. I mean, it's hard to try to sell people in year three of this. You're sitting at 0-18. Like, that's, you know, I think they have gotten an extraordinary amount of patience from the fan base for the most part for the first 2 years. I think the crowds were what they were, but I think for the most part people said, you know what? We understand what you're saying. We appreciate what you're trying to do, and we're going to give you a chance. And, you know, you got 2 years of basically the same thing. And I think people started to lose a little bit midpoint last year when they traded Michael Carter Williams, because they were starting to play really pretty consistent basketball at that point, and then it all kind of fell apart again. Now, as you look, Michael Carter Williams just got benched in Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the trade looks a lot better from a Sixers standpoint. I think it's a little bit beyond that. I think it's just more of the people that are claiming this is a perpetual rebuild and that there's never light at the end of the tunnel. They're just going to keep moving parts and moving parts to keep pushing the end line. Those people's arguments get more and more steam here as, already, I mean, it's 18 games in, but 12, 13 games ago, you already had people starting to talk about, not organization people, just kind of basketball fans, talking heads or whatever, talking about this coming draft when the Sixers will have four, could have four first-round picks, and they have a kid down there, Saric, who's over in Europe, who could come over, and then the perpetual question of, well, could this be the time next season when Joel Embiid finally plays? But I think it is wearing on people, and then you throw all this Okafor stuff on top, and it is a lot for people to swallow for a team that hasn't won a game yet this season.
Matt, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for giving us a few minutes of time today, my friend.
Same to you, sir. I hope you had a great Thanksgiving. We'll talk to you next time.
Matt Leon, KYW Philadelphia. Erica Walsh coming up, Ben Jones, StateCollege.com, and Frank Bonanni, York Daily Record. Big show today. Head to the bottom of the hour. We're in the Sunbury Motors studio. Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Key Routes 11 and 15 in Hubbell's Wharf on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
All right, Sunbury Motors, Key Routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf. Our thanks to Matt Leon, who joined us in the opening half hour. In a few moments, Ben Jones, StateCollege.com. And then in the next half hour, Erica Walsh. The Penn State women's soccer team in the College Cup Final Four Friday at 5 o'clock against Rutgers. Final half hour, Frank Bonanni, York Daily Record. First, this day in sports history, 1924, the Boston Bruins and the Montreal Maroons played in the first NHL game to be played in the United States. It was played at the old Boston Arena. In 1964, the Houston Colt 45s changed their name to the Astros. Why? Because in 1965, they moved into the Astrodome. 1967, Seattle was awarded an American League franchise. They were the Seattle Pilots, played 1 year, were the subject of Jim Bouton's book Ball 4, and then moved to Milwaukee, where they are now the Brewers. 1967, Will Chamberlain set an NBA record when he missed 22 free throws. 1984, Doug Flutie won the 50th Heisman Trophy. Now, there's always been, sports is filled with mythology, and part of the mythology was that when he hit the touchdown pass to Phelan to beat Miami, that's it, it clinched it for him. The votes were actually already in. And in 2003, bidding began on the baseball that was deflected by Steve Bartman, the fan in the stands in the Cubs game. The ball was sold December 18, 2003 for $106,000 at auction. The foul ball appeared to be headed for the glove of Moises Alou in Game 6 when Steve Bartman reached out and grabbed the ball. The Marlins won the game 8-3. The Cubs then lost Game 7. And what they did was they brought it to Harry Carey's, had a ceremony, and they exploded the baseball. That's what they did at Harry Carey's. I've eaten at Harry Carey's probably 5 or 6 times. Not bad. All right, let's now change gears and bring in Ben Jones, StateCollege.com. Hi, Ben. Great to have you with us.
Let's start, obviously, with the Penn State football news. I mean, you know, what was your take on all of it?
I think it was a mixture of a few things. I mean, I think that when you watch Penn State's offense, there's no doubt that there are things that the program has to overcome, that it doesn't matter who your offensive coordinator is. Those are the kinds of issues that you just can't make go away overnight. You can't, you know, necessarily coach around them in so much that they just don't appear. But at the same time, I think 2 seasons in, you see the same sorts of issues with the offense. You see the same sorts of things that you feel like, maybe someone else has a better handle on, or in the very least has a different answer to some of those problems and how you'd go about trying to address them. I think from the standpoint of buying goodwill and buying some time, I think James Franklin makes a move that a lot of fans agree with. And whenever your head coach does something that fans agree with, that's always going to reflect well on him. And I think because of that, it's sort of a win-win in the sense that Penn State, gets to make a move that is probably in their own best interest. And at the same time, James Franklin gets to make a move to buy some goodwill from fans that, quite honestly, he hasn't earned a lot of yet. And that's not to say that he hasn't deserved it or hasn't necessarily done the things that Penn State needs to have happen to it right now. But at the same time, you know, fans are still getting to know him. That loyalty to him is maybe a little different than it was to O'Brien and definitely different than it was to Joe Paterno. So I think it's one of those things where you go, he gets a little something out of it. Penn State's probably better off with this change. And at the end of the day, it just sort of gives everybody more time to figure out how to get over some of these more larger overreaching issues.
I know, Ben, that, obviously I work on a different floor than you do, or, you know, or we'll be in a booth. So, I mean, Jack Ham and I will talk about what we see and, you know, with the program in general and so forth. What's the general chatter among the media guys? Because I mean, I read a lot of stuff and everybody seems to have, as far as I'm concerned, you know, a really healthy perspective on what everybody's watching.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a combination of sort of what we just touched on. You know, I think everyone in the media sort of understands the issues that the program's going through. And the fact of the matter is, you know, you can take five offensive linemen, but it doesn't mean that you can turn them all into All-Americans. And that's not necessarily John Donovan's fault. It's not necessarily Herb Hand's fault. It just comes down to trying to figure out where that line is between these are things that Penn State could and should be better at right now and the sorts of things that really, no matter what you do, there's no way to work around that. And that comes down to practice depth. That comes down to player depth. You know, I've always told people that it's not that Penn State doesn't have the talent, you know, in a lot of places on the first team. It's the fact that, you know, when Michigan State takes a break and they bring in their second team guy to give someone a spell or their third team guy on special teams who, you know, ran a 440 in high school and is a good talent there, the Penn State just doesn't have those assets yet. They don't have the depth, to really match all the way down the depth chart. And the more injuries that you pick up, you know, the more issues that you have, you just look at the impact that not having Carl Nassib and Garrett Sickles had on the game this weekend. And, you know, I think we both probably assumed Michigan State was going to win that game either way, but you take out a guy who's, you know, probably an All-American, should be an All-American, a guy who's had a great season in his own right. You move Zettel around, you don't have Jordan Lucas, you don't have Naeem Wortman. There's a lot of missing pieces. And when you can't replace those necessarily with guys at that same level or near to it, you know, it doesn't matter who your coordinator is on either side of the ball. Those are things that you just can't overcome.
Right. I've given people recently the example of when Michael Motti got hurt against Temple. You know, he had the two in-season knee injuries. One was against Indiana, his last one. But the other one was a game against Temple down at the Link. Nate Stupar replaced him. An outside linebacker from Michigan State got hurt, and John Reschke replaced him. Here, it was the replacements were going to be two hardworking people, but walk-ons. And so Manny Bowen and Jay Cooper had to have the red shirts taken off of them that they idealistically wanted to keep on them. So, I mean, even little things like that are actually personnel setbacks along the way, aren't they?
Yeah, and I think if there's one thing that James Franklin doesn't get enough credit for, it's the fact that he is very thinking towards the future. I think
yes.
When you look at the personnel decisions that they make, you know, they're deciding about how is this going to help us down the line? Is this going to help us more now or more later? And I think you look at Juwan Johnson, a freshman, who had been green-lighted this year to play as a true freshman. Everyone expected him to play, and then as Penn State's passing attack really didn't maybe look as good as people wanted it to, they sort of reeled him back in, said, look, we're not going to play you. We're not going to burn this year. You know, we're not going to burn this year of eligibility with you in an area where we're not going to succeed greatly. You know, we've got the guys that we need right now. We're going to save you for the future. And that's a difficult balance to strike because, you know, Penn State's trying to win right now. James Franklin's trying to, you know, look good as an offense and a defense right now. But at the same time, you know, he's finding that balance between what can we do to make ourselves the best team that we can be right now. And what can we do to be, you know, the best program we think we can be 3 years from now?
All right. So now the next cycle comes up, and of course, to find out about the bowl game. What I found interesting is that I read, you know, you're trying to read tea leaves and so forth, and I saw three bowl predictions, and they had Penn State going to three different games. How difficult is this?
Oh, it's certainly difficult. It's fun. I mean, if nothing else, it's a lot easier than a coaching search, which I can say.
Oh, that's no fun at all.
It's no fun at all. But, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that it depends on so many different variables that are hard to control in different conferences and everything. You know, I think we've seen Penn State play a bowl game, you know, over the past month in just about every state in the country. So, you know, it definitely seems to be at this point that it's going to be either the California, Nashville, or somewhere in Florida sort of situation, and I'm all for going to Florida, you know, and I think Penn State probably, if they get their pick You know, they say that they don't get the pick, but certainly, you know, I think if they're going to be courting anyone, it'll probably be Florida. I don't think James Franklin necessarily wants to go back to Nashville, and I don't mm-hmm. think Penn State wants to go to California just because it's way the heck on the other side of the country. But without a doubt, you know, every day it's a different prediction, it's a different place, and no one seems to agree, which is a bit different than it was last year, because I think around this time, everyone sort of knew that Penn State was going to go to the Pinstripe Bowl.
Yeah.
It was just sort of a matter of it becoming official, and this year it's certainly trending, you know, more towards a bit of a predictable situation, but without a doubt, there's a lot more options.
Yeah, the curveball in all of this is that the Gator Bowl, it's not called the Gator Bowl, but you know what? I owe Tax Slayer nothing. All right. The Gator Bowl and the Music City Bowls have different arrangements than other bowl games do that are associated with the Big Ten, meaning that they are obligated to take three Big Ten teams over 6 years. Now, there's 5 years left in the contract, and Music City still has to take three over five. And the Gator took Iowa last year, so they're obligated to two over five, which if they take another Big Ten team, they'll have one out of four. Does that complicate this at all?
Yeah, I mean, it does, because you're going to, you know, these bowls are always looking. I think you heard that a lot from the reps for the Pinstripe Bowl last year, that they're looking for teams that are going to be marketable in the area that they are and the games that are going to be the most interesting. You know, frankly, you know, Penn State travels really well, and that's always going to help that program when it comes to sort of, you know, selling itself to a good bowl or a nice location or what have you. But at the end of the day, you know, it comes down to what's going to be the best game that that bowl can put on. And when you look at those contracts and how they don't have to take a Big Ten team this year if they don't want to, if they think something else is on the table that looks a little more interesting, they can do that. And I think that sort of adds into the sort of circus that has been the past few weeks trying to figure out where exactly we're all headed.
Yeah. All right, let's get to basketball, because they'll play in the ACC Challenge game coming up tomorrow night at the Conti Forum at up in Chestnut Hill. And they're 3-2 right now. And Brandon Taylor only picked up two fouls Saturday, which allowed him to play 33 minutes, which allowed him to have 19 points and 11 rebounds. So, Ben, how smart does he have to be on the floor to keep himself on the floor?
Oh, he has to be very smart. And I think if Penn State's going to do anything substantial from the standpoint of just picking up some wins this year, it's going to come from Brandon Taylor being able to be on the floor, being able to be that sort of calming presence. I think you really can't say enough good things about how he's played this year, and really the career arc that he's taken. You know, we've met him and he was, you know, probably 30 pounds heavier, not necessarily the kind of Big Ten ready body that you wanted to see. And you look down the road, he's a guy that's playing hard on both ends of the floor. He's getting his points, he's getting his buckets, he's not fouling, he's playing smart basketball, and he's making the guys around them better. How much better can he make this particular Penn State team? That sort of remains to be seen, but at the same time, you get a performance like he's had these past few games. You take that on the road. You get some guys comfortable. You get him in a groove. You know, I don't think he'll ever be the sort of player that DJ Nuvo was from the standpoint of, we need a basket right now, let's give it to Brandon Taylor. But certainly, you know, as Pat likes to say, he's earning the right to take those shots, and to his credit, he's making them.
Josh Reeves, what do you see in Josh Reeves? Because, look, I mean, the shooting part isn't quite there yet. It wasn't there with Taylor Battle until he hit that three at the end against Seton Hall his freshman year, and then banged down two threes in overtime, and then at that point, Taylor Battle became Taylor Battle. I'm not saying that's who Josh Reeves is. He's already a better defensive player than Taylor Battle ever dreamed of being. But still, what do you see in him?
I think you see a lot of potential, because, like you said, he's already a better defensive player than Taylor ever was, and I think he brings that same sort of, if you back up a little bit, when Geno Thorpe left the program, there were some questions of who was going to be that sort of spark plug on defense that kind of has that little bit of edge, that can kind of be the gritty guy that's going to go and get it. Now, I don't think Josh Reeves is going to wander into anyone's huddle during a timeout to see what they're up to, but at the same time, he's definitely the kind of guy that's well-developed on the defensive end already, and your offense is going to come to you. I think it takes a little while to get the high school out of a kid. I think you saw in some of these early games, he's done a few things that you go, maybe you could get away with that against Poughkeepsie High School or something like that, but it's going to be harder to do, you know, when you're playing Michigan State. But those things come with time. I don't think there's any doubt he's got the defense down, and he certainly has the athleticism and the skill set to figure out the offense. So from you look at where he is right now, and you sort of go back to where Brandon Taylor was his freshman year, and you kind of put them on similar trajectories. That's maybe not a fair thing to do, but if you just say, if he can start here, it certainly seems like the sky's the limit for wherever he can end up.
Right. College basketball, you know, they have the space to do it, the room to do it, the flexibility to do it, but does a much better job than college football of setting up some of these matchups, for example, ACC Challenge, Gavitt games, things like that. What do these tell you in the non-conference, and how good is it for college basketball, in your opinion, that these are set up?
Oh, I think it's great. I mean, I think college football, in a certain extent, sort of tries to avoid those marquee matchups. I mean, obviously, you get the Michigan States and Oregon that play each other. You have those games that everyone circles on the early season calendar. But I think these things, especially because in college basketball, you can afford to lose big games and still have a great season. I think it's a lot of fun. You sort of get to see where you stack up against another team that's maybe on the same level as you or maybe a little bit higher. I think when you look down the road to next year with Penn State and Duke in the same tournament early season, obviously that's one of those things where you go, well, that would be interesting to watch. And I think that's really what it comes down to, because you have to make, you know, college basketball season is long, and really it just comes down to March. It doesn't really matter what Michigan State looks like right now. It matters what they look like at the end of February. So I think because of that, you know, it gives people something to get excited about. It gives you some great games. There have been great games early this year. You know, it gives you an excuse to watch Ben Simmons go up against some guys that maybe he wouldn't see in the conference schedule. So there's a lot of good out of it, and I certainly enjoy flipping around early season tournaments, seeing different teams and different players go head-to-head.
Early season, any thoughts on what you've seen in college basketball? Because I know you follow it very closely.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been a lot of fun. I like some of the early upsets. I like George Washington playing well. I like Ben Simmons has been a lot of fun. It's sort of tough to be the next LeBron and have that sort of staple to your forehead from the get-go, but I think he's been excellent. It's going to be a fun year, and it's been fun to watch Michigan State sort of find themselves. I've always enjoyed watching Tom Izzo and that team sort of find themselves throughout the course of the year, and it certainly seems like they've got the pieces working together. Early again, I almost didn't watch the Michigan State Kansas game because I just sort of assumed that it would go like every early season Michigan State game. Then they find a way to win. So, you know, you just never know, and it keeps you coming back. So I'm definitely, if there's one thing I'm glad that college football is almost over for, it's just the fact that you get to watch a little bit more hoops now.
Yeah, I watched some of the BC Michigan State tape. And the reason I picked that one out is because of familiarity with personnel at Michigan State to kind of gauge what Boston College is doing. Denzel Valentine is playing great basketball. Wow. I mean, he is playing like a senior with a lot to play for. He is going to be a tough matchup.
He is, and I think he's a testament to what Izzo is able to do, because you see he's been a guy that's been at that program for a long time, has always been sort of a role player. And then for him to sort of flip on that switch, I think it was Draymond Green that said on Twitter the other day that, you know, people, you know, NBA scouts and what have you have to stop looking with their you know, the sort of flash and everything that you want out of a guy, because if you put Denzel Valentine on the floor, you know, he's going to give you everything. And so far this season, you know, I think he's gone above and beyond maybe what even Izzo thought he was capable of. So it's been a lot of fun to watch them.
Yeah, I mean, he can play really a point forward. Ben, thanks so much. Appreciate the time.
Sure thing, Steve.
Ben Jones, StateCollege.com. Next half hour, Erica Walsh on Penn State's trip to the College Cup. They play Rutgers Friday in the national semifinals in Cary, North Carolina. Final half hour today, we'll have Frank Bodani from the York Daily Record. Back with more in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK. All right, welcome back. Great to have you with us. Top of the hour. Then we'll have our play-by-play call of the day. Obviously, it's the Monday night game last night where the Cleveland Browns, to their credit, are the Cleveland Browns. And then Erica Walsh will join us, the head coach of the Penn State women's soccer team, because they have won their way to the College Cup for the fifth time in school history, the first time since 2012. They'll play in Cary, North Carolina, against Rutgers in the national semifinals Friday at 5. It's on ESPNU. Erica Walsh will join us on the show next half hour. Final half hour, Frank Bodani, York Daily Record, along with our Bozo of the Day. So that's what we have coming up. Again, only the Browns can do it as the Browns do. Unbelievable. 5-7 teams will be allowed into bowl games. Now, one of those five-win teams happens to be Kansas State. Kansas State, by the way, is 5-6. They actually play West Virginia at home Saturday. And if they win, they get to 6-6. That would leave four openings. They've decided to do it by APR. In other words, academic scores. Illinois has already told them in no uncertain terms, we really want to go. We really want to go. Like, they sent the same group of guys that camped out at Penn State to get players, same group they sent to Indianapolis and camped out outside Emmert's office. So they're going to be there. But it turns out that Illinois was sixth in the APR. Sixth, which means they're below the cut line. And then Missouri said, we're not going to take a bowl bid, which then put Illinois above the cut line. Minnesota's already said they want to go. Nebraska's going to go, too. San Jose State would go. Wow. Nebraska was number one of those teams in APR. The team that would be left out would be Rice. Now, who would have thought that Rice, of all schools, would be last in APR? You figured they'd be first. All right, top of the hour. News is next on News Radio 1070 WKOK.